Good morning.
Morning.
My name is Eileen Gillespie, and I serve as the intern minister of this congregation. Welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton, a welcoming Unitarian Universalist congregation. Spirit of life and love, let us rejoice this morning for the many gifts of creation, for the bounty of our lives. Let us join together in support of those who lack the many comforts we enjoy. Let us hold one another in gentle reverence on this day, for we are here to celebrate, to worship, to be thankful for all we have. We have had life newborn among us this year that will carry our legacy into the future. We have had death among us this year that has given us tears of sorrow and yesterdays to remember. We have had illnesses, accidents, and surgeries among us this year that have reminded us of the fragileness of our lives. We have had marriages, reunions, reconciliations, and we have had, and still do have, this beloved community, our religious home, where we come together in love and compassion. For all of this, for our challenges and for our gifts, we offer this prayer of gratitude. Amen.
Thank you.
reading by Robert Walsh, More Than We Deserve. I heard the second Brandenburg Concerto played in honor of Bach's 300th birthday, and I was swept away. I remembered a story about the people who send messages into outer space. Someone suggested sending a piece by Bach. The reply was, but that would be bragging. Some say we get what we deserve in life, but I don't believe it. We certainly don't deserve Bach. What have I done to deserve the second Brandenburg Concerto? I have not been kind enough. I have not done enough justice. I have not loved my neighbor or myself sufficiently. I have not praised God enough to have earned a gift like this. Life is a gift we have not earned and for which we cannot pay. There is no necessity that there be a universe, no inevitability about a world moving toward life and then self-consciousness. There might have been nothing. Nothing at all. So since we have not earned Bach or crocuses or lovers, the best we can do is express our gratitude for these undeserved gifts and do our share of the work of creation. I read earlier this morning from Robert R. Walsh's More Than We Deserve, in which he says, life is a gift we have not earned and for which we cannot pay. I have preached on this favorite poem more than once, and in reflecting on my experiences with the Partner Church program, Walsh's sentiments came up for me again and again. I have not been kind enough. I have not done enough justice. I have not loved my neighbor or myself sufficiently. I have not praised God enough to have earned a gift like this. There is no check large enough that I or anyone could write in compensation for the experiences that I have had with the Partner Church program. I'd like first to say a little bit about this program and the Partner Church movement. While many of us who did not study religion as an academic discipline envision our liberal faith as a relatively modern invention, perhaps of American descent, this is not the case. Our faith has deep roots in 16th century Europe, where alongside the Protestant Reformation, a Transylvanian named Ferenc David, or as he is often called in English, Francis David, renounced the dominant beliefs of his time through radical teachings, arguably becoming the world's first Unitarian. The popular Calvinism of Francis David's time taught that Jesus Christ was the only mediator between God and humans, and that Jesus Christ, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit formed an unshakable Trinity. While Francis David, conversely, emphasized the use of reason and the existence of a personal God whom all could access. And as Francis David stood on a rock in Coloșvar, Romania, he declared, Ege az Isten, God is one and not a Trinity. At the same time, universalism, the belief that all human beings will eventually reconcile with their creator, and that none are damned to hell, was emerging in many progressive Protestant groups around Europe. These are the roots of our liberal faith, which tie us to religious communities around the world, but particularly to Romania, which is where this congregation's own partner church, Olas Telek, is located. Now forgive me, I'm about to use a very large quote, but I think it's worth listening to. In their literature, the UU Partner Church Council uses the slogan, parity, not charity, to describe its aims for the partner church movement. And so in their words, partnerships provide individuals, small groups, and full congregations a way to meet, to connect with the larger fellowship of our faith. Our models are based on parity in partnership and not charity. We value building relationships between UUs that benefit us all in both small and large ways, like improving cultural understanding, supporting communities, and helping to develop individual, religious, educational, and economic opportunities. Partner churches base their work together around building relationships. They do a variety of things to keep those relationships going. Partners write, video conference, email, and keep in touch through social media to build friendships that can last a lifetime and cross borders. In addition to minister-to-minister connections, partners focus on making connections that are broad and reach into the community. These include connections with religious education classes, business people, women's groups, music, and religious education for children and adults. Partners share their understandings of our common liberal religious values and live firsthand the reality of the interdependent web of all life. Visits both ways by ministers, church members, youth groups, and even choirs bring these connections closer. End quote. The UU Partner Church movement began 20 years ago by building connections between North American UU congregations and churches in Romania and Hungary. These congregations are historically Unitarian. Later partnerships were formed with Unitarian Universalist congregations as this North American iteration of our liberal faith spread across the world to the Philippines, India, Nigeria, Uganda, Burundi, China, and other places. And as the Partner Church Council explains, partnerships take many forms, with their overarching goal being to build worldwide community and solidarity. Many congregations are able to facilitate pilgrimages for the purpose of coming to know one another more deeply. These exchanges go both ways. My home church, Mount Vernon Unitarian Church in Alexandria, Virginia, has taken many partner church pilgrimages to visit Sent Haramshag, its partner, in Romania. And I fondly remember, too, hosting the choir from the Unitarian High School. Yes, they have a Unitarian high school in Coloșvar, Romania, when they came to sing up and down the East Coast about 10 years ago. What a joy it was to introduce my Transylvanian friends to American culture. The things that my teenage friends from abroad seemed most captivated by included Mexican food, gym class at my high school, and the fact that American grocery stores include entire aisles of toothbrushes, when in Romania there are one or maybe two toothbrush options available, even at the biggest stores. And some of you in this room may remember, too, hosting our partner church minister, Reverend Alpar Kis, when he came to America about 10 years ago and preached from this pulpit. So as an 11-year-old, freshly graduated from the sixth grade, I was lucky to go on one of my home church's early partner church pilgrimages to Transylvania. I'm happy to say that up to that point, my parents were able to raise me with a good degree of awareness about my privilege as an upper-middle-class, white American. I had not been shielded from the world's poverty and inequality, but I had also never really experienced those things firsthand. I had grown up in a house with four bedrooms and in a family where each one of my parents owned cars. I also grew up in a culture in which the nuclear family, parents and their children, is the norm. So imagine my surprise when I came to stay in a host family in Sent Haramshag, our partner church village in rural Romania, and my host sister's parents and grandparents shared a room, and that room was the kitchen. They had fold-out beds in the kitchen, one of the house's three rooms. I, on the other hand, was given my own room, actually my host sister's room, and she was relegated to sleeping on the pull-out couch in the dining room. They had so little. They didn't even have a bathroom indoors, or a phone, or a paved road for that matter. At that time, 2002, Sentharamshag was about a 20-minute drive from a paved road, and only three or four people in the village had indoor plumbing. Now I keep up with my friends from the village on Facebook, although it's true that many of them have internet, but still do not have running water. As an 11-year-old, I was amazed and shocked by how little people seemed to have. But yet somehow, they had an endless supply of gifts for me. Gifts of time, love, and special foods prepared just for me, since I was the first vegetarian to ever travel to the village. I remember being told by the trip leaders what types of gifts to bring as thank yous for my host family. Practical gifts like socks, gardening gloves, and being reminded to leave the gifts at the very end of the trip without saying anything, since if the family knew I was giving them gifts, they would in turn give their own possessions to me as gifts. And this has since happened many times. I have lots of pot holders crocheted by Transylvanian grandmothers in my Boston apartment, and my dorm room in Florida was adorned with rag rugs made out of my host family's old clothes. But these physical gifts are so little in comparison to the spiritual and emotional gifts I have been given by my travels with the partner church. I have visited my home church's partner village 7 or 8 times now over the last 15 years. I have so many beautiful memories of my time in Sentharamshag. We would take hikes up the big hill, from the top of which the whole village and its neighbors were visible. I would be shuttled around to many different relatives' houses for meals and desserts. Almost every night, someone would host a dance party for the youth of the village and the young people visiting from America. Sometimes we would take trips to neighboring towns or important historical sites, beautiful medieval cathedrals, walled cities, and pastoral villages. But the memories that are the most precious to me are of ordinary days in the small, dirt-floored home with my host family. I often take afternoon naps when I visit Romania in the warmer months, since the summer heat is often hard to bear without air conditioning. And my sleep, at night as well as during the day, is usually blighted by the dozens of flies traveling in and out of the house. Anyone who's ever been on a farm will know what I mean. Many of the partner villages in Transylvania are remote farming communities like Sentharamshag. One day on my first trip, I was taking an afternoon nap and woke up suddenly to find my host father sitting next to me. He is a very strong, muscular man with big hands like bear paws, who works outdoors all day, farming and blacksmithing. And his favorite pastime is drinking palinka, Transylvanian moonshine. I woke up that afternoon on my first trip to the village to find him seated next to me on the bed, fanning the flies away from my face so that I was able to sleep peacefully. I spoke no Hungarian and he no English, but he just patted me on the head and sat with me as I drifted back to sleep. I'm pretty sure that every single time I have visited my home church's partner village, my host parents have asked me if it would be possible for me to move there. When their only child, their daughter Erzsébet, moved to America, I remember my host parents telling my real parents that it was time for a trade. Since America had gotten their daughter, they would get to keep me there. I have so many memories of them. Being given a bath in a tin tub in the kitchen, waking up in the morning to find that each and every pair of shoes I had brought with me on the trip had been painstakingly cleaned and polished by my octogenarian host grandmother. Sitting in the kitchen with my host mother while she made dozens of donuts, speaking in a combination of broken Hungarian, Romanian, and English, I asked her, "Are we having a party?" She replied that no, they were just for us. "You will have to share them with me," I told her. "No," she said, "they're all for you. All for me." While I was preparing to write this sermon, I thought too about my home church's second partner with a Unitarian Universalist church in Northeast India in a town called Maulat in the state of Meghalaya. I haven't been on a pilgrimage to visit our partner church village there in the Khasi Hills, which is a northeastern state far from the mainland of India. But I have spent much of the past 5 years in India, traveling, living, and studying all the way from India's southernmost state, Tamil Nadu, to the northern Pakistani border in Punjab. And when I consider my experiences in Transylvania, transposed onto my time in India, it brings me to think about cultures of scarcity and cultures of abundance. Both of these places, Romania and India, nurture cultures of generosity. They are places in which it would be thought normal to make dozens of donuts just for the visit of one person that you love, or to give away your own possessions as a thank you. So many things have happened to me in both of these places that astonished me because they were so far outside the culture in which I was raised. And while my parents are very generous people, and I grew up in very caring circles, it was still not my experience to grow up in a culture of such generosity. I remember riding the train in India. It was January, and my friend and I were riding general class from Delhi to Ludhiana in the northern state of Punjab. I was fresh from the airport when he picked me up, and we headed to the train. We had no food with us and planned to eat whatever was available on the train, usually some fried snacks, chips, and tea. The journey would take 5 or 6 hours, and we were riding general class. And in India, that's the section of the train in which they will sell as many tickets as people want to buy. I have had trips in general class where I have stood the whole way or sat high up in the luggage rack above the people's heads. On this trip, the windows of the train would not close, and we were shivering under shawls and blankets on our journey north through the foothills of the Himalayas. Luckily, we did get seats. Two men in their mid-20s sat across from us, and I watched them chat amongst themselves and could discern in Punjabi the words, "foreigners, no food." I watched them pull out shiny steel lunch pails of homemade food, more than likely cooked by their mothers. "Please," they said, "you must eat with us." There was not even a question of us not eating with them. We must. Or I remember early in my first trip to India when I was living in Chennai, in the deep south of India. I rode the bus every day to school, which was a very economical option at apparently 4.5 cents US dollar. So I was riding the bus and I was so surprised the first time that someone sitting next to me offered me a liter bottle of water. And I looked confused, and she motioned for me to drink. The big bottle of water was being passed all throughout the bus so that no one would go thirsty. This has since happened to me dozens of times in India, and yet I still flinch when a stranger asks me for a sip of water from my own bottle. This could be my slightly germophobic nature. I will not deny that. But to me, it speaks more to the culture of scarcity in which I was raised. We have so much here, and yet we are taught to guard what we have with such care, lest someone undeserving take it from us. It's such an unsustainable culture. In the words of the poet Khalil Gibran, author of The Prophet, "Is not dread of thirst when your well is full, a thirst that is unquenchable?" Of course we could have run out of water on the bus. Sometimes I took 5 or 6 or 10 hour bus rides in India. But no one seemed worried about sharing what they had. I remember passing through a toll booth in the state of Punjab a few years ago. I had my headphones in and I was startled when I felt a knock on the window of the bus. A group of Nihangs, a nomadic sect of Sikhs, had camped on the side of the road near the toll booth and were cooking flatbreads furiously to keep up with the flow of traffic. The man in the tall blue turban who knocked on my window handed me a flatbread and then, seeing my touched expression, told me, "May God take care of you," as he bounded onward to the next bus with his basket of warm bread. One more small reminder that yes, there is enough. There is more than enough. The poet Khalil Gibran has wise words about what I would call our culture of scarcity. There is this idea in the model of charitable giving that we are giving to those who deserve it the most. Gibran says, "You often say, 'I would give, but only to the deserving.' But the trees in your orchard say not so, nor the flocks in your pasture. They give that they may live, for to withhold is to perish. Surely he who is worthy to receive his days and nights is worthy of all else from you. And he who has deserved to drink from the ocean of life deserves to fill his cup from your little stream. And what desert greater shall there be than that which lies in the courage and the confidence of receiving? And who are you that men should rend their bosom and unveil their pride, that you may see their worth naked and their pride unabashed? No. See first that you yourself deserve to be a giver and an instrument of giving. For in truth, it is life that gives unto life, while you, who deem yourself a giver, are but a witness. We give that we may live, for to withhold is to perish. There is this idea in our culture that we get what we deserve, but truly we have earned none of it. In our American culture, which has such a focus on scarcity and who deserves our help, things often feel like they're all about money. But we give aid and express solidarity in all kinds of ways. We can write letters to our partner church, advocate for global policies that help to empower developing countries, learn new languages, or reduce our consumption of products that exploit workers. We can travel to visit our partners or read books or blogs about what their lives are like. We can study their history. We can pray for them. We can send money to pave roads, to build wells, to educate youth about sexual health, or to bring fuel to the elderly to heat their homes in winter. We can fund the education of young people who may not have access to high school, never mind college. We can send books, or Beanie Babies, or crayons, or diabetes testing supplies. All of these are ways we can express solidarity with our partner church and with people around the world whose lives look dramatically different from ours. Ultimately, what I hope to get across in my work with the partner church is that this is not about charity. This is about solidarity, connection, parity, and friendship. This is about partnership and learning more about what it means to give and to receive. On the surface, our partner churches around the world appear to need our help. They live in homes with 3 or 2 or 1 or no rooms. Some people live in shacks and walk for miles to find clean water each day. And they need our aid in all kinds of ways. We can be in solidarity with them by sending a check, but also by questioning the systems and the conditions that are in place that make our money such a necessity for them. We can foster parity and solidarity by traveling to visit them or learning more about their lives here at home. When we put a human face to the developing world, we begin to do our share in the work of creation, as Robert Walsh says. And we begin to reconsider who is giving and who is receiving. I have received so much from people who have few physical possessions to offer. I have been witness to their radical generosity of spirit, and I have confronted my own predicament, the mentality of scarcity in which I grew up. What does it mean to do our share in the work of creation? It means to put a human face on poverty, genocide, corruption, inadequate sanitation, malnutrition, oppression, and violence. It means to develop a vision of our solidarity, of our common humanity, and then to act on that vision. It means to create and nurture relationships, to look pain as well as beauty in the face. For some of us, doing our share in the work of creation might mean embarking on a pilgrimage to Transylvania or India or to somewhere else around the world where people live in need of solidarity, humanity, and wholeness. If you feel pulled in particular to Transylvania, I urge you to talk with me about the trip that I am organizing for this spring to visit our partner church. Truly, my travels to Transylvania and India have been some of the most formative experiences of my life. So ultimately, participating in solidarity and parity means giving humanity back to those who have been dehumanized. We do this by offering our time as well as our treasure. Because life is a gift we have not earned, and for which we cannot pay. We give that we may live. May it be so.